We'll call the Legislative Oversight Committee on Minshew to order. We have Representative Hoppe on the phone. We've extended an invitation to Senator Sharon. I don't know if anybody's reached her at this point. And we'll get right into the meeting. I think that we're not going to do a roll call, but approval of minutes from the January 9th, 2014 meeting. It's been there. Representative Atkins moves adoption of the meeting minutes from January 9th. So approved. Any additions or corrections? So approved, seeing none. And we're going to start with a testifier that needs to go, and we will have further that needs to leave early, but we will have further public testimony later on in the agenda as well. Jonathan Burris. Thank you for coming and being willing to share your story. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Jonathan Burris. And I'm happy to be here, and I wish I'd brought my binoculars because you're a long ways down. And these glasses don't work. But I want to start off by saying that this is a particular honor and privilege for me to be invited to participate in a democratic process like this on the 205th anniversary of Abraham Lincoln's birth. And thank you for that invitation. As I understand it, the purpose of this legislative committee is to search for the truth of the matter as it concerns implementation of the legislatively created Minshew healthcare insurance marketplace. I believe there were some authors of that legislation in the room today. It seems especially appropriate on this particular day that I honor the committee members' efforts with one of President Lincoln's not-so-well-known quotations. He said, "I am a firm believer in the people. If given the truth, they can be depended upon to meet any national crisis. The great point is to bring them the real facts." And I'm hoping that that's what you folks are doing today, and I appreciate your efforts. Again, thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members, for this opportunity to tell my story concerning my experience in using the Minshew marketplace. And here it is. I've operated a small business in Minnesota since 1985. I'm a sole practitioner lawyer, currently focusing my practice on life and estate planning. I've purchased paid for health insurance from four or five companies during that 25 plus years. In every case, the outlay for premiums was and is the second biggest chunk of the monthly nut I have to crack to keep my business afloat, enable me to provide valuable legal services in my to my clients. That chunk was working its way into the biggest chunk category in 2015, when I went back, or 2013, when I went back into the market to search for more affordable health insurance tailored to my particular needs as a, quote, cow's tail baby boomer. That's, and an end quote. That's, my mother called me the cow's tail, so and I'm definitely a baby boomer, so I thought that worked. Anyway, last fall I attempted to enter the Minshew marketplace online. My expectations were low because I had been reading all of the negative press about it, and in retrospect, I didn't try very hard to understand the process, because I believed I was doomed to fail. Also, I didn't really understand that Minshew was a marketplace for health insurance. I thought it may be health insurance itself. That was my own clouded understanding. In November, I was discussing my fruitless experience with another sole practitioner lawyer, and he informed me that part of the program included trained, quote, navigators, end quote, who could assist health insurance shoppers in obtaining insurance which could fit their particular needs, and he recommended that I schedule a shopping session with the Minnesota AIDS Project navigators, which I did. I met with the MAP navigator one morning in mid-December with my Blue Cross Blue Shield policy renewal deadline looming in January 1st. She spent a couple hours with me discussing the goods and bads of the policy I had with BCBS, what my present health care needs were, all the while creating an account for me, which she occasionally attempted to submit to Minshew online. Those attempts failed in the first couple of tries. She explained that a variety of technical difficulties caused the site to be down for periods of time, but she used the facts I provided to her to devise another strategy for submitting it to MNsure and receiving a substantive response. Her strategy worked. I was able to obtain a new policy that was much more affordable than the one I had. The premium amount was about the same, but the policy coverages for preventive care, the deductible, co-pays, medication for a chronic condition were very substantially better, and it was to be effective on January 1st, 2013, so I would not have any gap in coverage. Well, I said I better try this. So in January, I had my annual physical with my longtime family doctor. All was well. He declared me fundamentally healthy, which I thought was rather outrageous for a guy that's really conservative in his assessments. And once again, he prescribed the very expensive medication to treat my chronic condition. Medication I've been purchasing for years through a Canadian pharmacy because my local pharmacy had to charge me hundreds of dollars more. Under my new policy, 80% of the cost of the medication at my local pharmacy was covered by health partners. I am now a much happier camper and am extremely glad that MNsure was there to help me in my, quote, pursuit of happiness, end quote. The end. Respectfully submitted, Jonathan Burris. Thank you.
Jonathan, thank you for coming and telling your story. It is good to hear stories of people who have had a positive experience and gotten to the marketplace that we were working to create. There's a lot of stories of folks who have struggled. Any questions of members?
I do have one quick one.
Representative Atkins.
And Mr. Burris, I apologize if you said this. I was actually talking with Mr. Kwapik briefly, but you said in your written testimony that your policy you found it much more affordable, I think is what you described it as. Did you actually say how much more affordable, if you don't mind me asking?
Well, there are so many different pieces to it that, you know, it's not just premium. That's what I learned. You know, we all focus on that premium payment and making the nut, you know, on a monthly level. And actually, in the Blue Cross policy I had, it was a quarterly premium payment and obviously much bigger. But so it was the nuances that made it more affordable. Like, okay, it went to monthly. There was coverage for a lot of things that that otherwise weren't paid for by my other policy, my previous policy. So that's why, no, I don't have a number I can give you, but after working with the navigator, it became clear that doing these comparisons of things that were necessary for my particular situation.
I got it. So it's, and Mr. Chair, Mr. Burris.
Representative Atkins.
Sounds like, so when you add all of the components together, and I know you're making pharmacy choices about buying out of Canada and so forth, but when you add all the pieces together, your policy was actually more affordable than, and all the various payments were more affordable after versus before?
Right. The coverage. I'm looking for the coverage. Because when I'm going to be 61 on Friday, and, you know, we're all, there's the gap for 4 years before I'm eligible for Medicare, and my friends are dropping like flies, it seems like. So I don't want to lose my home and so on. So that's the cost on a day-to-day basis isn't as serious as to me as what good medical care, and I know where to get that. We have a lot of that available in Minnesota, and Health Partners happens to be in a network partner for where I get my treatment from this longtime doctor and that sort of thing. So that all was another thing that worked.
Representative Atkins.
And just one final question. By the way, happy Valentine's Day and happy birthday on Friday.
Thank you.
Any advice for other small business people that might be in a if there's, I'm sure there's lots of folks at home watching this legislative hearing. Do you have any advice for other small business owners?
Mr. Burris.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Keep your monthly nut to a minimum, and considering that health care costs and premiums for insurance are such a significant part of that, shop well in your health insurance.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions of members? Thank you.
Thank you.
And really, thank you for coming and sharing your story. With that, we'll move to an update from the Minshew Board Chair, Brian Buettner. And, you know, from that, we'll go on to CEO Scott Leitz. And I know that since the last time we met, we've had the end-to-end review by Optum completed. I'm certain that we'll spend a bit of time going over the findings from that and have a good discussion. With that, welcome to the committee, Mr. Buettner. State your name for the record.
Thank you. I'm Brian Buettner. I'm chair of the board of Minshew. And I do thank you for the time. I appreciate the time and the agenda to provide an update since we met just about a month ago. You know, I'll make my remarks brief. I just want to highlight some of the things we as a board have done in that last month, because the board is still pleased to serve the state and serve the mission that this legislation created to help ensure that every Minnesotan resident and small business, regardless of health status, can easily find, choose, and purchase a health insurance product that they value and does not consume a disproportionate amount of their income. The board continues to play an active role in the oversight and direction of Minshew. While the day-to-day activities of Minshew is in capable hands of Scott Leitz and his team, the board has stepped up its detailed review. When the board established Scott as Minshew's CEO, we did so with a purpose. We didn't just throw around new titles lately. We did it for a purpose, and the purpose was more accountability, more transparency, and more focus on making Minshew successful over time. To that end, in the past month, we've demanded some actions that are already starting to bear fruit. You mentioned the end-to-end review. Optum came in and provided an assessment similar to what they've done for other state-based exchanges and for the federal government, and they did it for free and on an expedited basis. More regular and consistent information is being demanded of the Minshew staff for the board to provide a view into the daily activities of Minshew. At every meeting, we've started releasing a dashboard of metrics. And while it's still a work in progress, it allows a couple of things. It allows more transparency about what is happening at Minshew, and it allows more time for us as a board to debate the direction and the strategy. So we spend less time debating how many 834 files have been sent, and more time talking about the direction and what can be done to improve the experience for consumers and for all Minnesotans. You may recall that the Optum report outlined improvements in three critical areas: call center, program management, and software and data. Minshew has taken action in all three areas. In the call center, we added staff immediately. They're on site and working today. In addition, we have a contract in place for significantly adding resources through the end of open enrollment. And I understand from the chatter in the room here before we started, those folks are actually, half of those folks are working here today. With respect to program management, Minshew has reorganized its internal management to reinstate the IT decision-making process that fell apart during the launch. Scott's also added senior staff with decision-making authority to eliminate choke points that previously slowed Minshew. And Minshew has offered, issued an RFP for a prime IT contractor with the goal of getting that in place by March. And you may recall that, you know, this is a function that Minshew assumed during the build phase of the project. And getting experienced professionals in this role now will enable Minshew to prioritize and manage the IT deliverables better. With respect to the software and data, having that new prime IT contractor will assist the board as it determines the direction for IT. The Optum report addresses the software and data issues really on two time horizons. There is a short-term issue of what can we be doing today as far as daily fixes? What should we be doing for the fall 2014 open enrollment, which, believe it or not, is coming upon us very quickly? And secondly, looking at the system architecture for 2015 and beyond to put Minshew on a more stable platform and position it for long-term success. The board has already started those discussions about both the short-term and the long-term, and with the help of this committee, our advisory committees, and all interested stakeholders, we'll move quickly to set realistic goals and direction for Minshew to improve upon the existing functionality. As a board, we're responsible for Minshew. While thousands have been helped, many have had serious problems with Minshew, These problems are unacceptable, and we apologize to all Minnesotans who've been affected. We know there's a lot more work to do before MNsure lives up to its full potential. While this goal will take time, it won't be accomplished overnight. Scott and his team are taking steps to improve the MNsure experience, and we see weekly improvement. We're also talking about a process that will cover many months to continue that improvement. In fact, getting MNsure to full maturity is something that will take years. This is not something that's new. It's not something that's come upon us in the last month or two. If you'll recall, you know, from my first involvement when we were appointed last spring, it was always viewed as a multi-year project to get this to full maturity. There'll be more bumps along the way. That's the nature of a startup, and that's really what MNsure is. And the board will continue to dig in, lead, push, and assist management to make that happen. One just final comment before Scott talks a little more specifically about the progress of MNsure in last month. For me personally, I continue to be surprised, pleasantly surprised, at the support we've received across Minnesota for what we're building. Minnesota remains unique in this country. We're the only state where we have broad support from the various stakeholders necessary to make an exchange like this work, from the legislative branch, the executive branch, to other administrative agencies like Commerce, Health, and DHS, to the carriers, to the providers offering up their networks, as well as hundreds of community organizations. And you heard the testifier talk about the navigators that he used to get through. The amount of work that each of those organizations have put in has been above and beyond not only their expectations, but everyone's expectations. But it's all working to benefit to create a fully functioning public market for health care insurance. It's a great testament to what Minnesotans can do together. That cooperation and collaboration has already started to deliver real results for Minnesota. Not only do we see the lowest premium rates in the country, whether you buy through MNsure or not, but over 90,000 Minnesotans have better, more affordable health care coverage than they've had. Whether one agrees with the federal legislation or not and its impact on insurance pricing in the marketplace, 90,000 individuals have chosen to obtain coverage. I believe in the free market, and I believe that those people would not go through the hassle, because unfortunately we do make it a hassle, and the expense to make that choice and say, I'm going to sign up and I'm going to find some coverage. I can only assume that it's better than what they have today, or they wouldn't go through that time and expense to do that. I appreciate the patience and the persistence of all our stakeholders, including you legislators, to continue to improve access to health care coverage in this state. Thank you again for your willingness to serve on this committee and devote your time to making sure this succeeds. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Buettner. I see Scott Leitz coming up to the table. You know, I know that with the Optum review, you know, you've told us that you've made some structural changes in the oversight. And I know Scott has Mr. Leitz has a great deal of additional insight into that. That there's also the IT planning and the RFP on the street. But I know that one of the questions we're going to want to hear is kind of the timeline. They kind of laid out three different options for moving forward and getting to 15 and 16 in terms of how we approach that IT build. And I think that there's going to be a great deal of interest just in the timeline of how decisions are going to be made and how the board is approaching that. So I'm certain that's no surprise to you, but maybe unless members have particular questions for Mr. Buettner right this minute, we'll allow Scott Leitz to give his initial thoughts and then move to questions for the two of them. Mr. Leitz, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Scott Leitz. I'm the interim CEO at MNsure. The last time I had the opportunity to address this oversight committee, I was fairly new on the job. I think I'd been on about 3 weeks. And now I've been on in this role for a little longer period of time. So one of the things I'd like to give you a little bit of a sense on is the progress that we've made over the course of the past 7 weeks or so in I think, improving the experience for Minnesotans and also improvements overall. As Chair Buettner mentioned, we do have over 92,000 people now who are enrolled through MNsure. And that's up considerably from the number I gave you the last time that I was here. We continue to make improvements that will, we believe, drastically increase that number, particularly as we move into March, when we know the open enrollment period will drive additional people to seek health insurance coverage. One of the things that I'm happy to report on is that the call center, which had struggled, and we talked a little bit about that the last committee hearing, has had a reduction in wait times. We're running between 5 and 15 minutes now compared to what were closer to 60 minutes previously. I'll talk in a few minutes about the improvements that we're going to continue to make there to drive that considerably lower than that. We've also seen that the initial experience that people have when they come into the website through the IBM Curum software, while there needs to be additional improvements made to that software, the success rate of people coming into the system has improved from around 70% to over 98% now, meaning that about 98% of the people are able to pass through that without problems. And that's a considerable improvement over 6 weeks ago. We also know that when we look across the system and we look to see where error rates have occurred, back in November, we would have reported a number to you in terms of error rates of around 17%, meaning when a person clicked, they would get an error. That number has dramatically dropped to around 4 to 5% now. So there are improvements in the system. There are still 4 to 5% challenges, too. And so I don't want to minimize those, but I also want to note that there have been improvements that have been made. And what we know and what we're hearing from people in the community, the Navigator community in particular, is that they are experiencing an easier time getting people enrolled through the system. And so that is a positive for us. We know their challenges remain for interactions with both the Navigators as well as the agent broker community. That's something we're strongly committed to improving as we move forward. So while we still have a lot of work to do here, I did want to report on some of the progress that I think we've been making. The other thing I was able to announce to you the last time I appeared here, and I know that Mr. Buettner already referred to this, is that we had Optum come on board and conduct an end-to-end review of the system, and that was done in January. And they reported back on January 14th and really looked at three main areas that we asked them to focus on, our call center, our online marketplace itself, and the internal IT management processes that we have in place. I'd like to give you just a brief update of our progress in each of those areas. With regards to the contact center, I mentioned earlier that that wait times now, without having added a modest number of additional staff, are down. Part of that is driven by the fact that the site is functioning better. Part of that is driven by the fact that the type of calls that people are getting into the call center are more typical call center calls than what we had initially, which were almost more help desk type calls. And again, that was a function of the underlying challenge that the system had. That said, we know that there are there's additional work to be done in this area. In particular, as we move into March, we know that the open enrollment period will likely increase volume to the site. And so we've been working to add additional call center staff with a contract to an outside vendor. We will be bringing on 100 additional call center staff. 50 of those staff are starting today. We've been going through a training period with them, and they actually go onto the phones today. 50 will be going onto the phones on February 19th. It's our goal in adding these additional staff to really bring the total number of our people up to closer to what it should be to handle the types of volume of calls that we will likely be handling. And our goal is to ensure that we have a customer experience which is closer to what Minnesotans should expect. And so that is what the goal is in adding those additional individuals. A second area that we looked at, we asked Optum to look at, was really our underlying IT system. And what that actually looks at is the components of the system itself, how well or not well were they working together, and what suggestions did Optum have in that regards. One of the suggestions and recommendations that they made is, given that you have a modular system that's built, meaning where it's built with different components by different vendors, one of the things that is important in a process like that is ensuring that there is a lead on ensuring that the vendors are working together more close across the various areas. And when they say a lead, I think it was referred to as a prime vendor earlier. A general contractor would be another way of thinking about it. But a single organization that we can go to ensure has accountability for making sure that the vendors who are doing the coding are doing that work. On Sunday, we issued what we call a statement of work, or an RFP, which is the next step in identifying that external vendor who can fill the role of that general contractor. We really think it's important and critical that we bring on some external expertise to ensure that the vendors on the ground who are doing the coding are working together, that we're driving to a common set of priorities, and that we're all working together to do that. We'll also be working with this general contractor or prime vendor to sketch out the longer-term goals for MNsure. Chair Buettner mentioned in the in his remarks, one of the things that Optum did was analyze what our pathways are moving forward for the site itself. The prime vendor will have initial responsibilities for improving the system as it is now, but we also want to engage them in helping to facilitate a process of decision making with regards to the site itself moving forward. And so they'll have responsibility in that area. We will be inviting several firms with proven track records to make proposals to us, and we hope that this prime vendor will be in place by the end of the month. That is our goal and the timelines that are laid out in the RFP. We've also moved quickly since the Optum report to reinstate the IT program decision-making process that was in place before October 1st. After October 1st, as challenges cropped up with the website, IT upgrades and fixes were implemented on more of an ad hoc basis and not necessarily following a strict or disciplined protocol. It's understandable that happened given the circumstances and given the challenges at the time. However, we desperately need to move to a more structured decision-making process that will serve MNsure and the state in the long term, and that's what we have moved swiftly to put back in place. That process is in place, I'm happy to report, and that is functioning well. The prime vendor will be, as they come on board, will be really working directly with our overall IT management structure to ensure that priorities are set in a reasonable way, in a timely way, and then driven down to the vendors for coding so that we can make rapid improvements to the site. The final thing I want to mention is that we have also, Mr. Buettner referred to this in his remarks, but we've also moved to internally structure the way that we do our operations within MNsure in a more logical way. There were several choke points in decision making, and so I've moved to really try to remove those choke points so that we can ensure that decision making within the organization is done in a smooth manner. And in that vein, I've established two deputy positions. The first position oversees our operations work, and this would include operations of the call center, our interactions with the IT vendors and other areas. And on yesterday, Wes Koistra will begin joined MNsure in that role as deputy director for operations. He served 20 years in senior executive posts.
Mr. Leitz, I think just to, so the governance structure, the organizational structure members have is the black and white, and, oh, I guess some members have. The other one with the internal structure of MNsure is also a handout for members, just to follow along.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for reminding me that we put those in the packet. Wes has served 20 years in senior executive posts at several high-profile public agencies. He, before coming over to MNsure, was the deputy regional administrator for Met Council, where he basically oversaw operations for the Metropolitan Council. So we're very pleased to have someone of Wes's expertise, knowledge, and experience moving into this role. And we've also moved on our communications and information front. We know that that's also a very, very important area because what we know about MNsure, we want to be able to ensure that you know, that the public knows, and that we have a good communication flow. I think that has been in the rush to do all of our work, that's one of the challenging areas. And so we want to make sure that we've established a positive role there. And so we've hired Allison O'Toole to serve as our Deputy Director for Communications and Public Affairs. She comes to us from the local firm Himley Rapp, where she worked with private and public sector clients, but also worked in state government, where she built coalitions around public health initiatives. She will be overseeing our marketing, our public affairs, our outreach, and the various media relations that we have. And so, Mr. Chair, we're just very excited to have to be moving forward to, I think, begin to be structuring MNsure in a way that can be sustainable in the long term, both internal to our organization, but also moving to make improvements to the external facing portion of this, which is the website, and to really be on some positive tracks, we think, to improve the citizens of Minnesota's experience as they come in through the site. So thank you for the time.
And on this one, that's the internal structure under Allison O'Toole, I noticed the navigator liaison, the broker agent liaison, and general outreach that, you know, I think communication with some of these key groups that are critical to success is a big piece of what you are trying to undertake here. So there's the top person, but some additional communication protocols being added.
Mr. Chair, thank you for bringing that up. One of the things that I think we've observed over the course, certainly I've observed since joining MNsure, but I think it was an observation before that time, is that there are some key groups that are important for ensuring that we maximize enrollment of people into insurance coverage. One of the groups is the broker and agent community, and they're a group that I feel very strongly that we need to continue to establish very strong relationships with. They are an absolutely vital source of both information and a trusted source of information at a local level, but also for people enrolling, they're just a trusted source of enrollment. So we are establishing a broker liaison position. We're also going to, when that's in place, move to establish a broker advisory committee that will be giving us advice and feedback on how we can improve that interaction between our groups. The second area is really with the navigators. And that's an area where we similarly are establishing or are continuing a position and filling that position. We have someone selected for that. They'll be moving into the job on the 24th. The broker position is about to be posted. We'll be filling that likely in March. So those are two areas that are really critical to making sure we have the community outreach, both through two channels that we know are very important to increasing enrollment.
And you mentioned in your testimony that you'd been getting feedback from navigators that the system is improving. And I will say, too, even in my conversations with navigators and with brokers and with carriers, that is a consistent message, that the system is improving. There's still need for further improvement, but there's been a clear turning and a set of improvements that are noticed out in the community. So that's very helpful. Now, you also mentioned that there was 92,000 people enrolling, and I should mention, you know, we made publicly available the MNsure dashboard with the numbers. Those are from February 5th, and as I looked through the black and white copies that are available, you know, some of the distinctions are impossible to decipher, but I decided not to try to get new color ones printed because my understanding is you will be presenting to your board a new dashboard this afternoon, correct?
Yes,
these are available online for anybody who wants to get through and see the details of the February 5th release, but later this afternoon there will be a new dashboard available. Is that 92,000, is that from the February 5th dashboard, or...
Mr. Chair, that's enrollment that we're announcing today. So
that's
that'll
the
be
enrollment for, that yeah. You'll be announcing yes. To the board this afternoon. Okay. Representative Atkins?
Yeah, please. And gentlemen, thank you very much for joining us again this morning. It sounds like by every measure there's been significant improvement at MNsure just over the last few weeks. I'm now actually feeling more sure about MNsure, and it's nice to be in that position. But, Mr. Leitz, you went through so many metrics. I just wanted to make sure I got the numbers right. After I get done here, I get to go visit with the Senate media folks. I try not to do that very often. But, And I wanted to make sure that I got the numbers right. So it sounds like as of now, enrollment is greater than 92,000. At year end, I believe it was 69,000. You said that the call waiting time now is 5 to 15 minutes versus greater than 60 minutes a few weeks ago. 70% of people a few weeks ago were able to get through the enrollment process. Now it's greater than 98% that are getting through the system without problems. Your error rates, I think you said, were 17% a few weeks ago and are now down to between 4 and 5%. That's one where I had a question mark. And then you added 100 call center staff, 50 that go online today or are working now, and another 50 on February 19th. What did I miss? I did my best to scribble rapidly, but am I missing anything in those figures?
Mr. Chair, Representative Atkins, you captured them well. The only, I would say, clarifications I would add would be on the error rate statistic that I cited. What we looked at there was, just to be clear what I'm talking about on that, when people come into a site, they click on things, right? And the link either takes you someplace or you have an error because things aren't communicating well. So essentially, if I could boil it down, it's as people come in and click, what percentage of the time are they able to get to the place that they want to go to? It's not a perfect metric of a person going through the system, but it's a better metric than what we've had up to this point of being able to sort of capture how well that's working. What the 17% figure I cited was really a mid-November figure, and the 5% figure, 4 to 5% figure, is a more current, up-to-date figure. So just to give you a sense of what the time periods were. But otherwise, I think you captured what I was saying.
And then, Mr. Chair and Mr. Leitzen, my request would be that you continue to report along these lines with the measurable sort of, you guys call them metrics, I just objective data that we can measure against and see progress, or perhaps if there's not progress, we can figure out what's what. And on that note, by the way, it sounds like you've made great progress on a number of fronts. Is there anything that's gone backwards in the last 3 or 4 weeks? Any problems that have arisen that surprised you or came out of?
Mr. Chair, Representative Atkins, one thing that I have learned to not be surprised at is that I'll always be surprised by something in this. And so there have been, obviously, as we deploy some fixes to the website, those occasionally do continue to cascade issues. The fixes that go in are typically fix what we're intending it to, but sometimes those will have additional effects that will need to then be addressed. So I would say that in terms of moving backwards, I'm not sure I would identify anything where we've moved anywhere backwards, but I would say that there continue to be a few bumps as we continue to improve the site. And so we'll take 3 steps forward and maybe a half step back sometimes.
Well, and, you know, on that metrics piece, I think that error rate is kind of an end-to-end. You're trying to track an individual from their entry into the system all the way through whether they were able to close the deal on a product. And I think that's really critical, and it kind of highlights where the improvement was needed and where your organizational structure and the additional the RFP that hit the street on Sunday is looking at some of that, because where you said you had gone from about a 70% success rate in the eligibility module to actually being able to get an individual of the proper eligibility determination over 98% of the time now, then it needs to be passed to the shopping and plan selection module, and then from there it needs to be passed to the payment module. I mean, broadly speaking, there's steps in the way, but I understand there was a lot of people having difficulty in the transitions between the modules of the product, and so my understanding is that's what this prime vendor and your more engaged organizational structure within the agencies, Minute, DHS, and Minsure, as well as internally within the agency, are intended to address that end-to-end consumer experience to get people, you know, from thinking that they'd like to engage all the way to being able to get into the product that works best for themselves and their families. And so that new error rate metric is one that I would really encourage you to because we haven't really heard a lot about that in the past. We kept hearing about the little silos, and they didn't tell the whole story. And so that's one I would really encourage you to continue to focus on and talk to us about. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to Mr. Buettner and Mr. Leitz. Thank you for making progress on a number of key things. I want to go back to what you were talking about earlier about selecting this prime contractor that you're moving on fairly quickly. And it seems to me that this is kind of a major new approach to sort of both the short-term and the long-term planning. Can you tell me who's going to be involved in the decision-making on the selection and on the criteria? Because I really do think this will have some implications, not just for how the system works for getting people onto health insurance, which we were really concerned about and was the first challenge of MNsure, but also this is going to be the platform for our entire DHS Health and Human Services eligibility system going forward. And so I would hope that that gets weighed sufficiently in that process. But who's going to be reviewing the proposals? Can you tell us? I assume it's your board that will ultimately make the decision.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, I'll start the question and pass it to Chair Buettner. Stepping back for just a second, one of the charts that we provided to you, I think, shows a little bit about what our IT governance structure, our IT management structure looks like and how that's made up. And what you see in that is that we have a sort of an executive team that's involved with high-level folks from DHS, from Minute, from MNsure. And the vendor selection team will really be a cross-agency team that will be made up of those of individuals from those agencies who are involved in the project and have been involved in the project and have expertise and knowledge in these areas. It's important to do that for a few reasons. The first is that, to your point, the needs of the public programs sit alongside the needs of private insurance and QHPs, and we want to ensure that we're selecting a vendor who will be able to understand those and be able to understand sort of the distinct overlapping but sometimes distinct needs that those two groups have or those two areas have. The second is that it's important for us to get, I think, a diverse mix of folks who are thinking about who should be involved and who they would be working with. And so everyone always reads an RFP a little bit differently and a response to an RFP a little bit differently. And so having a number of people involved who come from a variety of different perspectives is what we're striving for in that selection process. To your question about the board, this will be something that we'll then be bringing before the board for their approval as we go through that process.
And if I may.
Mr. Buettner.
Chairman Lowery, Representative Loeffler, I think Scott outlined it a great process because there are a lot of different constituencies that are going to be dependent on the technology that we're building and continuing to improve. And from a board perspective, there are certain things we want on this out of this vendor. You know, there are certain skill sets, whether it's planning, whether it's architecture, some of the things that we're charged with long-term, recognizing that some of the other players, whether it's Minute, whether it's DHS or other agencies, may want other specific things out of that vendor. So I think it's a good process for them to do the initial review, dig into those RFPs, and understand the technical skills. But ultimately, it's going to be our decision. It's going to be important for us as a board to understand how this contractor can help improve what we've done. I mean, to be blunt, and we had this discussion at the last legislative oversight meeting, MNsure as an organization took over that general contractor role last spring sometime before any of us in this room were involved, and it didn't go as planned, and it didn't go as well as people wanted, and so it's very important for us as a board to understand that we're getting somebody in place who can really step up and manage that process, both the short-term, working with the vendors as Scott outlined, as well as helping us as a board and as an organization understand what does the long-term architecture look like to support this state.
Well, and I think an underlying theme in that is that and we have a couple more questions from members, too, but it's one of the things I was saying, the Optum report gained a lot of press about the fact that there was three options laid out for how we plan our IT into the future. And the hiring of this firm, my understanding is would help make a decision. It hasn't made a decision that we're going to either keep all of the modules that we have today and try to fix them, or whether we're going to scrap and replace, or whether we're going to take a look at how each module is working and maybe replace individual modules. And broadly speaking, those were the three options that were laid out. But having this overlying prime contractor would help the board consider which of those three options is the most advantageous to get us to the end goal of having that better consumer experience, to get people to the marketplace that we've worked so hard to craft. If I could get a confirmation that that is.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Okay. Senator Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Chair Buettner, Mr. Leitz. With regard to this RFP that was issued, we've made it clear now that was the Maximus role that was pulled from them. Is it similar to that? And if so, how are we going to keep that from happening again?
Mr. Leitz?
Mr. Chair and Senator Benson, I think that's a fair characterization, that the role that Maximus was playing is a role that we will be asking this incoming vendor to play. And with regards to how we can sort of prevent that from happening again, I think was your question. I think our goal here is to select a vendor who has appropriate expertise for the tasks that we have in front of them, meaning the integration of the system, ensuring that the vendors are working together. They have expertise in IT projects generally overall and actually the implementation of them, and understand that world well, and also are in a position to be able to help us think through the next few months of which pathway we wish to follow moving forward.
Mr.
Senator
Chair,
Benson, the follow-up.
And Mr. Leitz, so what you just implied was that Maximus wasn't equipped to do that job, which leads me to, I had a request the last time we had an oversight hearing and I submitted a data request. Was Maximus the first choice vendor, or were they selected after somebody else walked away?
Mr. Leitz.
Mr. Chair, Senator Benson, here's how I would sort of characterize the Maximus role, and I'll get to the second half of your question as well. With regards to their role, I would say that initially they had the right skill set for what was necessary. There was a planning phase that needed to occur. Maximus did have expertise and does have expertise in business processes. They're very skilled in helping planning processes occur. What became apparent, though, in the spring was that the federal government had issued some requirements that we needed to drive towards, and we needed to rapidly drive towards what those requirements were going to be. The type of expertise from an overall perspective that Maximus brought was simply a different expertise than what was necessary at that point. That was when my understanding of the decision was made to move to a different type of an approach, moving Maximus out of that role. With regards to sort of the contract processes, I might ask my Mike Turpin to join me. I'm going to take a crack at answering your question from what I've gained as an understanding. Mike will be able to provide more clarification on anything I get incorrect on this. My understanding from the original bidding on this is that we brought in a number of bids on an initial phase. They included a number of vendors who were interested. My understanding is that we initially began negotiations or discussions with Deloitte, but weren't able to reach an agreement with them. And at that point, moved to more of a multi-vendor discussion, which is what we, in the end, ended up moving with Maximus as the prime vendor, but then the three that are on the ground doing the coding ended up being the sort of on-the-ground folks who put together the system. And, Mike, am I somewhere in the ballpark on that?
Mr. Turpin, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and offer your additional thoughts.
Thank you, Mike Turpin, General Counsel for Minsure. Mr. Chair, Senator Benson, that's basically correct. I think there's a few more phases in that evaluation process that preceded that. The original approach, as outlined in the RFP, was an option for either a single award to a single vendor to create all modules and build the full solution, also a multiple award option where you would have different vendors creating different modules with an integration approach. That approach was taken to begin with, a multiple award approach, or sort of a best of breed approach, working with each vendor to reach a separate contract with each vendor for each piece that they were responsible for. That was preceded, those negotiations proceeded for a little over a month or several months with an inability to reach mutually acceptable terms. At that point, the option was reviewed in terms of being able to proceed under a single award. At that point, only two vendors had responded to the request for proposal offering a single award. Those two vendors were Maximus and Deloitte. Maximus at that point was approached, both vendors were approached to see whether they were still interested in pursuing a single award. At that time, Maximus said that they were not interested, and so negotiations began with Deloitte. We're unable to reach mutually acceptable terms, went back to Maximus at that point to see if they were still interested or were interested at that point. At that point, they said that they were interested in proceeding. We proceeded to negotiations with the finalization of the contract being executed in July of 2012.
Senator Benson, a follow-up.
Thank you. How much do we anticipate paying this new general contractor?
Mr. Leitz?
Mr. Chair, Senator Benson, that'll be part of the process of soliciting bids. We don't actually have estimates from them yet at this point.
So you've scoped out a project.
We put out a scope of work, Mr. Chair, and then they'll be bidding to that scope of work.
And you'll review them.
Yes.
Representative Mack.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a couple questions back to enrollment and appreciate the slides and this information. I do understand you have updated numbers that we don't have in front of us yet. So I'll just go off of what I have and you can correct where need be. But my question is looking at page 6 on the slides.
This is the Minshew dashboard that's
yes.
available.
This one here.
I'm looking at the QHP enrollments and process one here, and it shows as of February 1st there are 28,611 enrollees with a goal of hitting right under 70,000 by April 1st, so about 6 weeks away, and that that's a bit of a gap between now and then. And then further on, you had mentioned that we're looking at about 2,000 new enrollees every 2 weeks, I think, is what was said. And so I'm just curious, the numbers aren't adding up in terms of hitting that goal. And so I'm just wondering your thoughts in terms of that gap and how at 2,000 every 2 weeks, which doesn't seem to be near quite where we need to be, how we're going to sustain and get to where we need to be and kind of what the plan is if we don't hit 70,000 by April 1st in 6 weeks.
Mr. Leitz?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mack, a couple things on that. The first is, I'm not sure about the 2,000 every 2 weeks. I think what we've seen since perhaps the last board meeting is an increase of around 2,000 people. So that's been in the last week or so we've had about a 2,000 increase. We did anticipate there would be some flattening that would occur after various deadlines. So typically what we've seen is as we approached, for example, December 31st, we saw an uptick in people coming in, getting coverage because they wanted it by January 1st. We did anticipate there would be a little bit of a flattening in growth in January and February because folks didn't have another deadline until March. And the numbers seem to be sort of playing out that way. We do anticipate that with the more hard deadline of March 31st that we will see an uptick in enrollment. I guess the data will tell whether we are able to reach the projections or not, but we certainly do anticipate that there will be a fairly substantial upsurge in enrollment in March.
Okay. Thank you,
Matt.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And so I'm just trying to remember the numbers off the top of my head because it makes sense. Before the deadlines, people tend to quick start to pay attention a little bit more, get their stuff in, then it kind of falls off, then it goes up again. So I'm just trying to remember, December 31st, how far, with that uptake, how far off were we at that point from what we projected we were going to be at, and where did we actually come in? I'm sure I have it somewhere. I just can't remember. And then does that give us any idea in terms of the April 1st? And then again, what's the plan in terms, is there a backup plan if we're 10,000 short, 20,000 short on April 1st in terms of budget and everything? Is there a contingency plan in place? And if there's not right now, Is there one in the works, and is that something that we would be able to see as a legislative oversight committee?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Representative Wright. Mack, thinking back to December and where we were relative to what projected enrollments had been for that, we did a comparison of that. I think we provided this to the Oversight Committee for the last meeting, if I remember correctly, that looked at what we knew about December enrollment relative to the fiscal note scenarios that were put together, where there were kind of a high, a medium, and a low projected enrollment. And then that sort of tied to what budget numbers looked like. What we reported then, what we have available right now, is that we are running at about 85% of the low enrollment scenario, so a little bit below the low enrollment scenario. Trending that forward, what we don't know, the next sort of piece of information that we'll have will be the March 31st enrollment, because that will give us a sense of where we're trending through a full enrollment period. It's a little hard to sort of do it in between in these interim periods because people aren't facing a deadline necessarily. So the next really good snapshot that we'll have will be through the March enrollment and what we do by March 31st. That'll be that piece. In terms of budget, I'll just say this piece. The 14 budget is sort of contained in our grant funding that we have from the federal government. And what we'll need to do over the course of the summer, as we get information back about what enrollment was, is start to make some decisions about what that means for our overall budget then, trending forward what we know from enrollment, what expected enrollment will be in the fall, and then what that means for the 15 budget. And we'll be working closely with the board on that.
Yeah. If I may, Chair Lowry, Representative Mack, we've asked the exact same questions that you just did. In fact, I think it was two board meetings ago, we had that sort of first look at what does 2015 look, just sort of straight lining out where we were today, recognizing, as Scott said, we're going to see different changes in enrollment over the next couple of months still. But just seeing where we were today, the projection in 2015 at that point in time with that current trend was looking at a deficit. And we as a board have already started discussing with staff, what are the contingency plans? Do we take out costs? What do we look at doing going forward? The other thing to keep in mind as we, learned as we looked at those projections is on page 6, we're talking about QHP. We're talking about commercial products sold through the plant, through Minsure. Obviously, public programs plays a large part of the population that we serve. And so what we've seen thus far is in my view of the world from a business perspective, it's sort of a mix issue. We are, we're servicing a lot of people. We are getting people in the system. But back to the fiscal notes that Scott referred to as to what projections people expected in a brand new marketplace, not knowing what to expect, we had estimates. And what we've discovered is the mix has shifted. We've seen more people enroll in public programs than those estimates were and fewer people in commercial programs. And so for me, it's as important as anything else then to dig in the next level and say, what does it mean financially to us when we get more people in public programs and we get revenue associated with that because we're providing services to DHS and they reimburse us based on how many of those come in versus the revenue that comes to us from the premium withhold on the QHP plans. And that's what we have that slated for discussion yet again today at our board meeting, and we'll continue to have it, as Scott said, certainly once March comes in and we have a much better look at what to project for 2015.
Representative Mack.
Yeah, just thank you. Just two brief follow-ups, and you led into perfectly one question I had in terms of the public programs versus the commercial, and I'll certainly tune in this afternoon to the board meeting to hear about that conversation and how that goes and kind of where the questions go. But I guess, one question, I brought this up at the last Oversight Committee, and we'll probably keep mentioning it just because I think it's a really important thing to kind of keep our eyes on, is the issue of, do we know that if Minsure is accomplishing the number one goal that it was set out to do last February when it first came before us, which was to make sure that those that don't have access to insurance or unaffordable insurance are getting a better product, things of that nature. And we've talked about this issue that up until this point, there was nothing put in place that would necessarily measure that, that wouldn't ask that question. It's to my, correct me if I'm wrong, but to my understanding, there's no point in the application process where a person has said, did you have insurance before or what did you pay before? And, you know, are you getting a better deal? Something to that effect to actually tell us, are we accomplishing the goal? And so I'm hoping that with this new vendor and kind of the new project management style going forward, that whoever gets that RFP or how that process goes, that it's a clear expectation put on that person that somehow they find a way to integrate a question or a way to measure if we are, to me, that's a critical question to know if we're even doing what we set out to do. It's a bit shocking that that wasn't something put in from the get-go, if this was, in fact, the biggest goal of Minshew or one of the biggest goals. So I hope that's corrected going forward so we have a measurable idea of are we doing what we hoped to set out to do by giving people more affordable care and better coverage. And so then I guess this, the follow-up to that is, one, is that something that will be expected going forward as we continue to tweak the vendor and adjust for that? But my other question was in regards to the vendor is, you know, Senator Benson asked about what we expect to pay this new vendor, and I understand we don't know that yet, but do we know where that's going to come from, where that money's getting moved from? What was it supposed to pay for? What's went now? Is it where's that getting moved from in order to pay for this new vendor to adjust?
Mr. Chair and Representative Mack, on your first question, let me just clarify up kind of what we collect and then where we're at in that process. As part of the application process, there is a question asked about whether the person has previous insurance coverage or has current insurance coverage. So we will be able to look at that. I think the limiting factor and where it might have been a little bit confusing was that we haven't been able yet to report that information out. It's on our list of things that we want to do. We know there's a lot of interest in it. I think we'll move that up in the priority list because it sounds like something that there's just a lot of, I think, legitimate interest in knowing some answers to. So we need to look at that. I think one of the things that I simply don't know the answer to the question right now is whether that's a required field or not. If it's a required field, we'll get a really good sample. If it's not a required field, we'll have to think about whether there's selection biases and other things involved with reporting out that data. But in any case, we'll be taking a swift look at that. So I appreciate the question. With regards to sort of the expenditures for some of the things that we talked that we've been talking about, we'll be looking within our existing grant budget for calendar year 14. And we'll be taking some hard looks at areas where we think there might be anticipated underspending. The budgets were set. You set the budgets for a year. Sometimes they meet and sometimes they don't meet. We have a little bit of experience now throughout the year, moving into February now, so we know a little bit about where some of the expenditures are. So we'll really be looking initially within our existing operating budget for 14 to achieve some of our goals with regards to the contracts that we've talked about. Beyond that, we'll have to make some determinations if those aren't sufficient, to whether there are additional opportunities, perhaps at a federal level, for additional dollars. But we won't know that until we do a good hard look at our own internal operating budget.
On the question, I was aware that there was a question whether you had have current insurance as you're enrolling, but I would be very surprised if we were able to make that a required field. I mean, I don't think we did or would make that a required field. You shouldn't have to fill out a questionnaire and give personal information like that. That's not actually relevant to your eligibility and qualifications for purchasing and getting a plan through Minshew. And we do have so while it may be difficult in a live environment like Minshew is bringing up, we do have, and we talked about this last time as well, a lot of tools in the state to try to track how people are getting their insurance, how people are getting their health care, who's falling off. And I know that there's a lot of thought being put into this, aside from the great effort that Minshew is going to be undertaking to try to do this. But we do also have to be very cognizant of the fact that these are personal stories, and we're not going to require that people tell their personal stories in order to purchase a plan through Minshew. So that's a key thing to understand, that it may be difficult in live time to get these real metrics, but we do have a long history of working hard to make sure that we understand how things work. And it might be frustrating, but we will be tracking that as those folks do their surveys and come out and help us understand where we got. With that, I know that Representative Hoppe has been waiting a while to try to get a question. Are you there, Joe? Well, we'll try to get you back on. Maybe he fell off. We'll come back to you as soon as we can. Sorry about that. I know Representative Huntley had a question as well.
Well, you know, I don't know if you're going to have staff come up here and go through these slides that we have, but I have two questions. One is most of the success stories that I've heard about involve going through a navigator or a broker rather than just doing it themselves online. And I don't have a good understanding of what the navigators and brokers are doing and what kind of monitoring you have of that and how much time that's taking. And Mr. Burris said he spent, I think, 2 hours with a navigator. So if in the future, if we could get a better understanding of what the role of the navigators, brokers, and how they're being monitored and assessed for what they're doing. And my second question is the SHOP program, which is a small business. That seems to be a disaster. And I think the individual market you've made great progress in, but the SHOP program is running at between 8 and 4% of what we had predicted. So what are you going to do about that?
Mr. Lights?
Mr. Chair, Representative Huntley, on your first question, we could certainly work towards, as we move towards the next meeting, getting better information to you around the navigator and broker info. We are starting, I think one of the things that we're learning is that our system is collecting a lot of data. We need to turn that into information that's useful to you. So there's this whole thing about having data but not having information. We want to try to continue to work off of our metrics but improve them moving forward so that we can get you stuff that's relevant. So we'll continue to do that and appreciate the input on that. With regards to the SHOP program, that's an area where I think it was as we've built the system up, it is one of the areas that we have in thinking about where to prioritize. It's going to be, it was sort of a, we wanted to prioritize on getting, ensuring that individuals who are coming through had the best possible experience. That's where we've been putting a lot of our resources right now. We know that as that piece has improved and hopefully will continue to improve, we can start to now look at how do we build out other areas like SHOP that where small businesses can come in. And we have the numbers are low, but the success stories are actually good when you're able to individually talk to those folks, and they are getting good selection of plans. But that'll be a next area of focus, I think, moving forward as we move into the spring and into the summer. So stay tuned on that, but we do know it's an area that needs to do better than it is currently.
And the SHOP exchange, is there the same open enrollment period for the SHOP customers as for individual?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Okay. Representative Loeffler had a follow-up on SHOP, and I just, for the record, we have Representative Hoppe back on the line. I know Senator Benson has a follow-up, and we are going to keep working to try
Mr.
to manage
Chair,
these.
If I could, I've just been clarified by my staff that I gave you incorrect information. So Katie Burns is going to join just to clarify up my incorrection.
Okay.
Good morning, Katie Burns, Minsher. Small employers have somewhat different opportunities. There's
what
a point in the year where they have to meet contribution requirements and participation rate requirements, and then a part of the year where they are able to come in without meeting those requirements. So that works a bit differently than the open enrollment period for individuals.
That didn't clear it up for me. So tell me, tell me what the deadlines are. When, you know, what can a small employer expect in terms of how long are they able to come and shop for the products that work for their particular set of circumstances?
So there is a 30-day period, Mr. Chair, between November 15th and December 15th each year where they can come in regardless of whether they meet participation rate requirements or contribution rate requirements, and that has to do with a participation rate is the percentage of employees that need to participate in the plan, and the contribution rate has to do with the percent of premium that the employer is contributing.
But I'm a small employer. Can I log on to MinSure and shop for plans today? I mean, I'm past that December 15th period.
Yes, you are able to do that, and that is through and so that can continue to happen through the duration of the open enrollment period for small employers, which is March 31st of this year.
Excellent. Thank you. Representative, maybe you should stick around because Representative Lapp has another shot at the question.
Well, Mr. Chair and members, I think the small business area needs more attention, and we can do that at a different time. But I did want to share an anecdote from a small employer in my area who wanted to get in through MinSure, ran into some of the technical problems early in October, kept working with our shop employees, and had said he was so excited because the broker insurance company he'd been working with had just kind of offered big increases each year, but not a lot of creativity. And then after some time of working with the MinSure product, his broker called back, and all of a sudden there were all kinds of new creative options at different price points, and he wanted to make sure that I knew that just the presence of MinSure and its options was changing his experience within the private market, and that's hard to measure, the spillover effect, but at least from this one small business person, he really felt that just the presence of MinSure and its pricing and its products was actually changing what was available elsewhere. And I'm not sure it's not going to be easy for us to sort of measure those impacts, but I think they're happening both on the small business and the individual market. And as we talk about research for the future, I think this is a topic that would be of interest.
Excellent. Representative Hoppe, are you back?
I am. Sorry,
excellent.
Mr. Chairman, thank you.
No, that's good.
I know some of this has been covered a little bit, but some of the questions I had dealt with how expensive things are going to get and how we're going to pay for all of the new employees and the new vendor. And I know that's been covered a little bit, but I'm wondering if it was covered and I missed it, I apologize. But with the new lead vendor and all the everything that's going on, are we still paying Maximus? Is that contract still in place?
That has not been covered. They're trying to figure out, Representative Hoppe, who's going to answer this question. So here comes Mike Turpin back to the table.
Sure. Mr. Chair, Representative Hoppe, currently under the adjusted status of the contract, they are continuing to provide certain services. Specifically some of the billing and invoicing services, but maybe more importantly some of the services related to rolling any adjustments or changes that we've made into the contracts into the three separate subcontracts that they continue to hold. These are not insignificant amounts of work related to adjustments that we've made over the course of the project that then need to be separately negotiated with the subcontracts that they hold with each of the vendors. Additionally, during up through just prior to October 1st, there were staff involved in issue tracking and some other federal documentation roles that they were providing directly.
So, Mr. Turpin, what I heard you saying is that, yes, Maximus does continue to get paid, but for work they're actually accomplishing, the general contractor role that they're no longer playing, they're not getting paid for that general contractor role, but there are still other deliverables within their contract that they are still performing, and they are getting paid for those. Is that an accurate summary of what
that
you said?
That is completely accurate.
Excellent. Okay. Representative Hoppe, you said you had a couple of questions. Did you have a follow-up?
Vendor, and I think people want to know how much more expensive it's going to be and how it's all going to be paid for. And I know a little bit of that has been touched on, but I think we need to keep all of that in front of mind as we go ahead. And then one last comment, and with all due respect, Mr. Chair, I think we have to insist that we know what we're doing, who we're covering. Have people had insurance before? I mean, if we're covering all people that had insurance before, what's the point of having an exchange? I mean, if the idea was to cover the 8 or 9% of Minnesotans that did not have insurance, we have to be able to, and I think Mr. Light said it in the meeting yesterday, that it's something they're going to try to look for, because I think you have to know how to measure this so we can determine whether or not it's working. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Absolutely, and I agree with your point that we need to answer those questions, and my clarification was that we need to make sure we're using many different avenues to try to answer that question, and we will stay focused on it. To the question about, you know, how much additional money,
Mr. Chair, Representative Hoppe, this is Brian Buettner, just because you can't see me on the phone. You're asking the same question we as the board continually ask every time we meet with staff about changes. And, you know, the good news is right now, as Scott has alluded to whenever we ask these questions, and he mentioned it earlier, is we look to reallocate within the grants that we already have from the federal government for 2014. So until it gets to the point where we have to spend beyond those grants, and we've got another review with Minshew this afternoon at our board meeting to schedule exactly that, to understand how much have we spent to the grants, what's already committed through 2014, whether it's for salaries or otherwise, and what's left, things that haven't been paid for because the grant didn't reach its expectations. There might be some savings in salary for overtime or whatnot. And so, you know, to directly to your question, as of this point, and I'm looking to Scott to tell me if I'm wrong, we're operating within the grants that have been awarded. So there are no additional funds being requested from the federal government or certainly from the state. As we start talking about 2015, that's exactly what we need to start looking to do, is understand, can we do it within a budget that we've set up? And I think Scott also alluded to, in particular, when we look at things like adding the general contractor, to the extent that we cannot find money within the existing grants, we have had conversations with the federal government about, will they make additional funds available for some of this, remediation work, for lack of a better term, right? We have grants to build a thing. There's nothing in the grants that says, well, if it's not working and we need to fix it, how do we do that? We're doing that through reallocation. But to the extent that we go over the existing grants, it's going to come to the board. It's going to find – we're going to have to find out whether or not we're spending that. I hope that answers your question.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Buettner, thank you.
Senator Hoppe.
Talking about the future in 2016, could we get Mr. Buettner to comment briefly on the President's actions from a couple of days ago and how that's going to impact the Affordable Care Act in general and Minshew specifically, please?
Sure.
Chair Lowry, Representative Hoppe, I wish that I were a federal policy expert. My quick back of the hand says, to the extent that we delay the mandate change the numbers from 50 to 100 as to the number of employees that are required for a company to provide insurance, that means there's going to be more individuals who aren't going to be covered by employer-based insurance. I mean, stepping back from everything we're doing here, 85% of the people in this country have insurance, have it through their employers today. To the extent that that gets reduced or lessened in any way, there are more people that we need to be serving through Minshew. If I were looking at this as a true business, which in large part it is, creating that opportunity and getting consumers in, it's an opportunity. And I mean it's an opportunity not in the fact that there are people without coverage, but it's an opportunity for us to reach more citizens and make sure that they get covered. That's my initial sort of quick read, but I am by no means a federal policy expert.
Senator Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Leitz, we're walking back a little bit. You talk about March 31st enrollment. Help me understand when people are actually supposed to have their insurance cards in hand. Because it used to be they needed 2 weeks. The insurance companies needed 2 weeks to process. Has that window compressed? Walk me through when they have to have cards in hand to not pay penalty, and then back up from there, and I do have follow-up.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to start. I'm going to ask Katie Burns also join us at the table, but I'll start to answer your question while she makes her way over here. She's been doing a lot of the interactions with the carriers on this piece. She's setting her computer down now. So the deadline, as I think the committee is aware, is March 31st. People need to be able to indicate when they actually, I believe, file on their taxes, whether they've had coverage or not, is my understanding on that. And so what we've been working with the carriers on is a process to ensure that they're able to get their cards within a period of time that is reasonable. Maybe, Katie, you can comment on sort of the process that we're going through with the plans and what the deadlines are that we've been working with them on. One of the things that has been a pretty high priority for us has been working very closely with the carriers in the state over the course of the past couple of months, and even a little bit longer, on literally a daily basis to work out some of these things. Katie's been sort of the on-the-ground person doing a lot of that work, so if you would mind commenting on that.
Ms. Burns, welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In response to the question about enrollment and payment deadlines, those are typically mid-month enrollment and payment deadlines. So what that means in a typical month is that a person needs to come in and go through all the way to the point of choosing a plan and paying for that plan by the 15th of the month in order to have coverage effective the first day of the following month. We had an exception to that in January, just given the first set of enrollment and payment deadlines, where consumers were able to choose a plan by December 31st and pay by January 10th to have coverage effective January 1st. But that was a very unusual circumstance. So more typically, we would, for example, for this month, we're looking at February 15th. That is the enrollment and payment deadline for having coverage in place on March 1st. March will be a bit of an unusual month, of course, because it's the end of the open enrollment period. And so one thing that was a peculiarity, I would say, of how the ACA and its implementing regulations were written is that initially, we had an open enrollment period that ended on March 31st, but enrollment and payment deadlines of March 15th. So the clarification that has been issued on that last fall is that consumers would be able to enroll. They could enroll and pay for a plan by March 15th for coverage April 1. And also that they could come in through the very end of March, through March 31st, to enroll and pay to have coverage. Their coverage would not be effective until May 1st, but that would be still considered as meeting the federal timelines. So I apologize for the lengthy response to your question, but it's just a bit complicated with respect to how those deadlines roll out.
And clarification, that's in regards to QHPs, qualified health plans, sold through the exchange.
That's correct.
I believe the deadlines are different, and the when you apply and when it's effective for the public programs is a little different story. Is that correct?
The public program deadlines are different. So those the payment deadlines, for example, do not apply to Minnesota Care. And I would defer to a colleague from the Department of Human Services to comment more specifically about those. But to clarify, those are specific to people purchasing private coverage.
Okay.
Chairman Lowry, if I may add a comment, Representative Benson, it's a great question, and this goes back to the comment that I said in my opening remarks about our stakeholders working well together to deliver better services to Minnesotans across the board. And this is a perfect example. We all think in the days when we grew up of the ID card was everything. If I didn't have that little piece of paper when I went into my provider, nothing happened. You know, the providers have been really good. The carriers have been good. I've been sitting in on these carrier meetings that, Katie has when my schedule permits. And what I've seen is exactly that, is the carriers will make notice to their network and say, hey, if we haven't gotten a card out as quickly as we would have liked, here's what you as a provider in our network should accept, whether it is, you know, getting confirmation through other sources at those plans, whether it's online, whether it's their phone calls, not just the ID. There's lots of other indicia to be able to, for a provider to make sure that they get claims sent into the right place. And that cooperation across multiple parties has been, you know, like I said earlier, one of the pleasant surprises is how well, as a state, we're working with changing rules from the federal government, clarifications of existing rules, and everybody's working together, say, let's make it work for that consumer.
Senator Benson?
And Mr. Chair, and Mr. Chair, as long as we've veered into the plans, what does the plan side of this looks like? I know they have gone through a great number of hoops in order to help MNsure be functional. Are they getting clean data? Are they getting clean 834s and 820s? At one point, I'd been told that some data was coming over and then a spreadsheet would come to verify it. What does it look like for the plans right now?
Representative Benson, Chair Lowry, I'll start and I'll let Katie finish because she's got the details, but certainly the data is getting to them and the data is getting good. And that's the whole point of these almost daily meetings, is for them to have that mechanism and that feedback loop. So the anecdotes that you hear, that we all hear of, well, this file didn't work right. I mean, I've sat in the meetings where exactly that. The carrier will say, this part of the file is not working, and, you know, Katie will work with the team to make sure that works. But I'll defer to you on the details as to how many are getting out, what's getting out, and is it working for the carriers?
Sure.
Ms. Burns?
Mr. Chair and Senator Benson, we are in a place with enrollment data where as of at the end of last week, we had sent almost 20,500 enrollment records to carriers through the standard electronic processes that we all anticipate that we should be using to transmit enrollment information. There are still pieces of some specific pieces of information that are not yet populated on those standard 834 transactions, and we are still working with our IT vendor on those specific pieces. So we're getting closer, but those are not yet populated on the 834 transactions, and both we and carriers are very eager to make that happen. But they are getting the data that they need, but it's not with respect to the pieces that are still not populating on the 834, we all recognize that we need to get those data elements populated because that just works better all the way around for both carriers and for MNsure. With respect to another component of the process, which is the transfer of premium payments over to carriers, we are also regularly making those premium payment transfers to carriers. And in fact, we're doing that more often than we initially anticipated on in doing that. We are not yet using a standard electronic format for transmitting related information about those premium payments, but the carriers are getting what they need through secure data transfer. So that process also needs to mature a bit, but carriers are regularly getting the premium payments for enrollees.
Ms. Burns, on the 834s and the data elements that you're still trying to work out, maybe it's too far in the weeds, but I'm a little bit of a data guy. What are the missing elements that you're working on? I'm not
sure. So there are several. One of them is, Mr. Chair, really in the weeds, a secondary address line. So to the extent that somebody has an apartment number that they haven't put on the first line of the application, that's a piece that we are transmitting through a spreadsheet. phone number and email addresses of enrollees, which are not required data elements but are certainly very helpful to a carrier to be able to have to contact an enrollee. Those are populated there, as well as broker information is on is not populating yet on the 834, but we are sending over the data that we do have. So those are the missing data elements.
That's helpful. Thank you. Representative Mack?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had questions from a few things ago that we talked about, and now I have a few more questions with this, so I'm just trying to figure out where to start. I'll start just in response to your some of the statements. I'm just trying to understand if I'm understanding the numbers right, in the commercial market, there's about a gap of, I understand, about 7,000 or 8,000 that the enrollment's in process but haven't yet been sent to the plans. Is that because of the issue that you just referenced with the 834s, and is that connected to that gap there? Because that was just going to be one of my questions, and I'm trying to figure out if you just spoke to answer that question and trying to understand your answer completely. So could you just speak to that gap and why that's there?
Yes.
Ms. Burns.
Mr. Chair and Representative, it is that does not explain that gap. So enrollment in process, it's worth explaining a bit about what that metric means versus the records that we would expect to be sent over on an 834. So when we say an enrollment is in process in the private market, what we're saying is that the consumer has come in and they have chosen a plan and a payment method. In order to be sent on an 834 right now, what our rules are is that you have actually come in and you have made a payment to MNsure, or you have said, MNsure, please have my health insurance company bill me. And those are the triggers that would have your record sent over on the 834. So to the extent that you have chosen a plan and a payment method, but you haven't actually paid, then that would explain the gap in those records. It's also, I also want to be clear, and we will work to produce more clear information on these metrics, but it is a little hard to line those up because the number of folks who have chosen a plan and a payment method that we are reporting, that is a count of individuals. The record count is really about the number of households or subscribers that are being sent, and in some cases those numbers, there are a portion of families that are purchasing both qualified health plans and a dental plan separately on MNsure, and to the extent that that is the case, the same household record would appropriately be sent to two different companies because they're purchasing two different plans.
Representative Mack, is that all clear?
I'm really trying here, and you're doing that was very helpful. Still a couple follow-ups just to understand. Okay, so first, does that mean in that gap that, you know, that maybe the 7,000, I'm just looking at, for instance, the commercial market here.
Mm-hmm.
If I understood that last part that you just said, does that mean there could be duplicate counting within that 7,000, or within those numbers, there could be duplicates where they're being counted as two different new enrollees when really it could be one household with two different tracks of insurance, one to dental, one to health. Am I understanding they could be getting counted twice? I just want to make sure I understand that really quick.
Ms. Burns?
Mr. Chair and Representative, that is correct. And appropriately so, because we're literally counting the number of transactions that we have sent off.
Okay.
And that is not a and we will provide breakdowns on that, but it is not that is not a majority of households by any by any sense. But I think we need to do a better job giving you a better sense of the counts and how they relate to that number of individuals who chose a plan and a payment method.
Okay, and thank you, Mr. Chair. And so basically we're looking at there might be two different numbers, one that says how many households and people are getting covered and how many transactions, and those would be two slightly different numbers because some people would have two different transactions going out, essentially. So there would be a little deviation in those numbers because of the way you're measuring it. And then my other, so, and the other thing I just want to make sure I understand, it sounds like the holdup of maybe the 7,000 applications that are in process but haven't been sent complete to the plans, the holdup there is because the individual has not elected a payment method or has not paid MNsure, and that's why it hasn't been sent to the plans yet. That last, if I understand, you said the 834 is completed once that person has either paid or selected a payment method, and if they haven't done that yet, it hasn't been sent to the plans. Is that, that's pretty much the sole reason for that gap that exists right now, or one of the biggest reasons for that gap?
Ms. Burns?
Mr. Chair and Representative, so the individual has chosen both a plan and a payment method, but the trigger is that they have actually made a payment or they have said, health insurance company, please bill me.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay, I have that part wrapped up. That makes sense. Thank you for that explanation. I don't envy your job. It sounds very complicated. Okay, so my other question is relating to the public enrollees versus the commercial market. And I know that, you know, we have an ongoing goal of trying to make sure that our commercial enrollment is staying on track to make this whole thing sustainable, because we know that those numbers are pretty critical to making this work. And one thing that I was actually trying to look at, and this is kind of back to the figuring out, you know, private or previous insurance coverage and where people are at in terms of are they getting the help they need. And I'll probably look between now and our next meeting, but I'm just trying to remember, and I feel like I've been over at the counties before and looked at what people who, when they enroll for public program, kind of what they look at, what they're having to go through and fill out and everything like that. And if I'm, and I've sent a text to a friend at the county and I haven't heard back yet, but I feel like I've seen that in the past, part of that is questions about prior coverage and understanding where people are coming from and where they're going to. And so I guess, you know, not to beat a dead horse on this issue, but I don't think it's too much to ask. I mean, I think of other questions that individuals have to answer when they're applying for government programs or public assistance. They get asked much more personal questions and much more private information than their insurance coverage status. I'll definitely do some checking into that and whether it can be a required field or not. But, you know, I think that that's something that would be to your guys' credit at, you know, a year from now, if we're able to measure, hey, we've hit the goals of getting people insured. And so, you know, I don't think that that's way out in left field to talk about that. And it just seems like there was something a bit broken from the setup of this whole system, that isn't something that we were able to get our hands on a little bit quicker. I do know we've got community measurement, a lot of things in the state that measure quality, but that wasn't inherently part of the MNsure system from the start is surprising to me, as it would so clearly be able to tell us, you know, if we're getting done what we need to do. My other question is for Mr. Buettner, and, you know, we talk about the budget, and I'm looking for a little clarification. I'm looking at this MNsure expenditure and revenue budget analysis, which is very much appreciated in this breakdown. And we're talking a little bit about the 2015 budget. And I'm just wondering, Mr. Buettner, when do you expect, I guess my first question is, when do you expect to have answers from MNsure staff and as a board regarding the 2015 budget? I understand it's a complicated process, but 2015 is right around the corner. And certainly getting that budget figured out is much sooner than that. And so I'm just wondering, when do you as a board reasonably expect to have answers to those questions that you have been asking? And, you know, yeah, I guess when do you expect to have that? And then I just have a couple questions about the numbers here.
Sure. So, Chair Lowry.
Mr. Buettner, and we're switching over, and I know Senator Benson had some questions in this vein as well. We've already covered a little bit about the enrollment, the 85% of the low enrollment scenario, and this is the proposal, the piece that was put together to cover the budget scenario for our last Legislative Oversight Committee hearing, but we did decide to include it in this package as well. So it Looking at it, it looks like the same one that was presented and discussed last time, but I think there are still some questions. And again, as I said last time, one of the key issues that I'm going to be looking for is, do you anticipate coming to the legislature in 2014 and asking for a supplemental budget to help support Minshew and make sure that we can meet the critical goals that we all share?
Chair Lowry, Representative Mack, I actually appreciate that clarification because I think it helps understand the timeline that you're referring to, because I don't think we're going to have a good sense for projecting into 2015 until open enrollment is done. So, you know, you're talking April before we have a good, really good data on which to base into 2015. Running into the legislative session and your timing, that's why we're starting the discussion today, and in fact just started it, you know, a couple of meetings ago as a board, is to start looking even preliminarily, what are we looking at? I mean, the report that excuse me, you're looking at was, you know, our first look at, are we talking about a large gap or a smaller gap? $2.5 million on one scenario in front of me. A lot more manageable than if it was a $25 million scenario. So that's what we're looking at today, is getting some sense of scale and scope and direction. But I do think it'll probably be April or later before we have definitive data from open enrollment of 2014 to project onto what do we expect in 2015.
Well, my recollection is there's actually a much more detailed budget required in the legislation to be delivered to the legislature by March 15th, I think, if memory serves. And so I think we should probably use that as March 15th, 2014, and every year thereafter. So, I mean, you're going to have to submit a detailed budget to us as a requirement of the law by March 15th, and hopefully we'll have as much detail as you can possibly garner, because it is a matter of great interest to us as we deliberate what our proper role is.
Mr. Chair, I agree with you. I certainly want to meet any requirements that we have, and as you were talking, we were talking on this end of the table, and Barb's already working on that, as she said.
Excellent. Ms. Julek, I see, did you have some additional comments to add at this point? Probably stick around. I think we're going to ask a couple of budget questions, it looks like. Representative Mack.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So then looking at the numbers that we have in front of us right now, and I guess kind of going off of what's been rehashed out earlier, that, you know, as of January 1st, we were 15% less than the lowest projection. We were operating at 85% of the low projection. So, you know, it's not exactly the best news as of January 1st. Hopefully things continue to pick up before April 1st, but I would think that as trying to be prudent with the dollars, we would operate under almost a worst-case scenario, and then anything is icing on the cake after that. But as good financial managers, I know in my home when we budget worst-case scenario, and then hopefully it just goes up from there. And so we're not working from zero here. We've got some idea where we're going to end up. I don't think it's a shock to anyone in the room that it would be a very pleasant surprise if we hit, for instance, in the commercial market, that $70,000 enrollment mark, but it would be fairly miraculous with that being six weeks away to actually hit that. And so the concern obviously being, you know, where do we go from there, and how do we get those enrollment numbers up, or at what point do we just completely adjust our expectations? And to that point, as I'm looking at this spreadsheet here, I'm just trying to understand in the very bottom kind of darkest gray section where it says current enrollment trend scenario, I'm seeing under expenditure reduction for scenario a $16 million cut, if I understand that correctly, which still leaves us $2.475 million in the hole in 2015, if I'm understanding that correctly. So right now, that expenditure reduction has not been put into place. So essentially right now we're looking at about an $18 million hole in 2015. We already know that as of today. Is that a fair understanding, or that's what's being projected?
Mr. Chair, Barb Julek, Minshew Financial, or CFO. No, we don't know that today. I think that's what we want to wait till the end of March to see where enrollment does fall, what we do have to look at. What that $16 million figure did represent are areas where there's more, where the costs are more transactional based on the number of people, that's where that adjustment is. I think as Chair Buettner and Director Lights indicated, we'd also want to look at other areas of what were our actual costs and needs, and kind of do the total review of where there are other areas we could look at. So right now that $16 million represents a couple things. One, mostly the variable cost on those transactional items that are dependent on an enrollment. And two, what is the mix between public and private? So there's a little bit involved in there as well. What proportion is public versus what proportion is private? And so that's part of that $16 million as well. If the greater proportion is public, obviously they would share in a greater proportion of the cost, or vice versa, depending on how it went. So there is a combination in that number.
Okay. So,
and a little bit of housekeeping, and we need to move over to Senator Benson pretty soon. It's in the same vein, probably similar questions, but a little bit of housekeeping. We are going to try to adjourn as close to noon as possible. We might run a little bit over, but they do have a board meeting at 1. We weren't aware of that. I mean, it was on the calendar, but we weren't aware of that as we discussed the next meeting last time. So out of respect and allowing people a little nourishment, we're going to try to end as close to noon as possible. With that, Senator Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and my apologies to Representative Mack. Okay, first of all, I'm reading statute. It says beginning March 15th, 2014, and that is House File 5, Conference Committee Report as passed by the legislature and signed by the governor. Not optional.
We agree.
Okay. And Chair Buettner, do you believe you have the authority to transfer funds from other agencies without going to the legislature? For example, MA transfer from the Healthcare Access Fund.
I don't know.
Mr. Buettner.
Chair Lowry, Senator Benson, I have no idea what you're talking about, to be honest. It's not my job to run the rest of government, and when we come up with ideas, certainly I'll run them by staff and find out what are our restrictions.
Chair Buettner and Senator Lowry, we already transferred money to cover the public programs, and now the public programs are becoming a disproportionate part of miniature enrollment. And our public programs shouldn't have to bear more burden than they would have otherwise cost. And everyone here knows our public programs could have been managed by the counties. They didn't need the added cost of MNsure to obtain the enrollment that has been done. The counties were already doing it, and with some push and a little bit of outreach, we probably could have gotten to these numbers. And so any indication that public programs should have to bear the burden for poor management, I think, is something the legislature should be left to decide. And also, if I may, Senator Lowry.
Senator Benson.
There is a cash flow provision from MMB. And if you decide that is in the mix, obviously Commissioner Showalter is here. I think engaging with him and his agency on what a budget should look like in order to gain some surety, because if you borrow that money with a budget that looks like this, I don't know how you pay it back. And so I am very concerned that your options for revenue are exceptionally limited. And as much as you might be asking Mr. Lights, we're getting perilously close to decision time. And so what's going to happen needs to be decided expediently. And if you need to come to the legislature, it's going to have to come fairly soon.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I could add, from my perspective, MNsure would not be able to spend out of the Healthcare Access Fund without coming to us for an appropriation. I mean, I believe that to be fairly clear. That said, the expenses on the public program side run through DHS are actually the cost of providing the package of care to the individuals, and that is not MNCHR's responsibility. The cost allocation that went from DHS and is part of MNCHR's budget is intended to account for the eligibility and enrollment work done on behalf of MNCHR. And it has been widely acknowledged that that has not been as smooth a process as was intended. But that is the piece. It's important to understand that that's the piece that we're talking about in terms of MNCHR's budget. And Chair Buettner alluded to that earlier, that there's a cost allocation for the work in eligibility and enrollment that was intended to be done through MNCHR. And hopefully, as we improve the IT build-out and get on top of these systems, that will smooth itself out. And truthfully, in the counties, had we chosen to, you know, opt for the counties to continue doing this work, you know, I mean, they are actually looking at reduced efforts by the counties once we get over this hump. And that is something that the counties were very, very interested in seeing occur over time. Again, fully recognizing the level of difficulty that we have experienced in the initial rollout here, but those are some, you know, rather critical clarifications to add. I don't know. And then was there a question, any response from the table? Was there a question that you were hoping for a response, or you'd like to try again?
No, okay. Mr. Chair, I just keep hearing we're talking about the budget, we're right. talking about the budget, we're talking about the budget. And at some point, somebody's going to have to make a decision.
Absolutely.
And as a part of this oversight committee, I'd just like to have some sense of where the board is looking for that money. I know we've talked about the feds. There's the line of credit from MMB. And so as you move forward, being clear on a sense of direction for how this is going to be funded, I think the people of Minnesota, I particularly, would like to know.
Any further questions of members? Representative Mack?
Mr. Chair, I don't know if she's still here. Is Commissioner Jessen or...
Commissioner Jessen is here.
Oh, I was just wondering, as we're on this issue of kind of the DHS budget a little bit and interaction with public programs, if we have time for a couple of questions now, but if we have time before noon.
Yeah, so. And then, yeah. Representative Mack.
Oh, okay. Well, for Commissioner Jessen, I guess I'm just wondering
Commissioner, would you like an opportunity to offer some initial comments, or should we just jump to questions? Do you have something you'd like to...
Do you have something you want to say?
to say in introduction. Welcome to the committee, by the way.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I'm certainly happy to answer any questions that the committee members have. Also with me here, if they're detailed financial questions, is Deputy Commissioner Chuck Johnson, who's also been very involved in this.
Representative Mack.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner Jessen. I appreciate you being here and just taking a couple of questions. I guess just kind of to dovetail off of Senator Benson's questions, can you shed a little light just on the budget situation in the DHS budget in terms of the interaction with the DHS budget and the 12-13 biennial budget and what's gone from that? Have there been unexpected expenditures that have been out of the DHS budget that have gone to MNCHR and any interaction there between the two that were maybe unexpected or covering costs in MNCHR for public programs?
Commissioner Jessen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mack, I mean, what has gone to MNCHR really has been, you know, as set out in the cost allocation that was referred to, process that was referred to earlier. You know, I didn't bring up here with me when I came up. I wasn't sure what questions you were going to ask, the exact numbers, but I can certainly go back and get the numbers, or Mr. Johnson can provide you with exactly of the IT, you know, build, what was allocated to DHS. As far as that cost allocation, then when you look at the DHS allocation, you know, 90% of that basically was paid for by the federal government, 10% by state funds, and those state funds were appropriated, you know, the initial ones in the 2011 legislature and then, you know, additionally last year. So that, you know, I would say, Mr. Chair, Representative Mack, that certainly at the department we have spent, you know, a great deal of time and effort, you know, assisting with the manual workarounds necessary to make sure that we have coverage for public program enrollees. You know, that is something that we are managing within. So, you know, numbers, you know, over time, you know, adding additional temporary staff. You know, for an example, you know, we have had 13,000 paper applications because we saw that as a need to make sure that we, particularly for public program enrollees, that they got coverage. So we've, you know, brought in additional staff to do that. We have done that, you know, within our, you know, within our budget, and we've been making sure that things that we're doing for MNsure, we are allocating back to MNsure, and we have a process. So we have people keeping very detailed records of what they're spending for DHS versus what they're spending for MNsure, and then kind of allocating those costs back, Representative.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Commissioner,
Representative Mack.
Appreciate that, Commissioner Jessen. And I understand, I listened to the board meeting, I believe it was last week or 2 weeks ago, kind of talking about some of the IT issues within DHS and moving forward, trying to get better communications between DHS and MNsure. And I believe, is it optimization or what is the IT infrastructure that's been put in place in DHS? And I'm just curious, could you explain how that process is supposed to work between MNsure and DHS in terms of getting that information back and forth? I understand there have been a lot of paper enrollments at this point, or a lot of paper transactions, just with timing and things not going quite as we'd hoped in terms of the IT infrastructure. Can you let us know what does that system look like now, and what's it supposed to look like when it's up and running fully and functionally?
Commissioner Jessen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mack, those were a lot of questions in there. Let me do the best I can. And as I think Mr. Buettner said earlier, this is, you know, we really, it's going to take, you know, really probably a year or two to have a system that is functioning the way we want to. So what MNsure is set out to do for public program enrollees is to be able, so that they can go online and find out if they're eligible, and ultimately, we hope, also enroll and choose in a health plan. Right now, we're just starting with a subset of kind of our medical assistance enrollees, not everyone, but all those that kind of we call the MAGI population, a lot of our children and families population, as well as Minnesota Care enrollees. So the idea is that MNsure's the kind of the technology would handle that those eligibility decisions for us. And the kind of the current product, the IBM current product, kind of had a set of rules, and the idea was that those rules would kind of apply so someone could go in, check the verifications, check to see the eligibility, and tell a person if they are eligible. And then, and long term, we wanted them to be able to also choose their health plan, you know, online as well. I think that functionality, you know, right even now is being handled through our regular, you know, our more normal past process of, you know, with the counties. So what we're, I think that you and many of you all know that we have very outdated systems that the counties and DHS are working for, you know, systems that were 20 years old, you know, and systems that were taking, you know, weeks, if not, you know, sometimes months to actually get people through this process and enrolled when they were eligible. So we really saw this opportunity of having this kind of 90-10 federal match where the federal government was paying 90% of these upgrades to really see this as an opportunity to upgrade our eligibility and enrollment system, which is, and that was something I think the counties felt very strongly about as well. So we really saw this as an opportunity to do that. That's why we went to the legislature in 2011 and again in 2013 to ask for kind of the state share of those funding so that we could do that. I apologize, you know, Mr. Chair, Representative Mack. I didn't bring papers up, so I didn't write down all the other parts of your question. And I also, if there are other detailed parts, you know, would be happy to have Deputy Commissioner Johnson come up and address them in more detail if you'd like that as well.
You know, and maybe I could just insert as well. So we've kind of highlighted what some of the benefits are of having a system that we envisioned, and we're still working on trying to fix the system to get there. But there's also a couple of core pieces that are federal requirements. There's a no wrong door policy. So we can't actually can't have a bifurcated system where people buying QHPs come to MNsure to buy their QHPs and people who don't are going through the county portal. That's not actually allowed, nor is it desirable. And the other piece is, even if we did set up a system like that, one of the core requirements of eligibility for the advanced premium tax credits for a qualified health plan purchaser is that first they have to be determined ineligible for your public programs in order to qualify for the tax credit. They could purchase a QHP without the tax credits, without that first step, but it's also a core required first step by the feds to make sure that that the individual, in order to qualify for the tax credits, is not eligible for any of our public programs. So, I mean, it really wasn't an option, in addition to all of the good reasons why we want to get to this system that actually works and serves the state of Minnesota, our people, and our families, and our businesses better. Representative Mack?
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Lori. And I just have one other question. I don't know if there's other people in line, so I don't want to monopolize. I had a question in terms of the infrastructure that's been built so far within DHS. Am I understanding that that's all those costs so far then have been borne by the 90-10 match, the 90% that the government or was drawn down from the feds? And then, if I understand correctly, and I'm trying to remember from last year, the state met that other 10%. Have all costs been completely borne within that pie, essentially, or has DHS spent additional funds or need to spend additional funds for this infrastructure?
Commissioner Jessen?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mack, just so that I can get you as exact as answer as possible, I'm going to ask Deputy Commissioner Johnson to answer that question, if I may.
Yeah.
Deputy Commissioner Johnson, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Chuck Johnson, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Human Services. Mr. Chair, Representative Mack, the cost for the IT system is first split between MnSure and Medicaid being the DHS portion. So that's the first piece of the cost allocation. There are different cost allocation ratios that we use for different parts of the system, depending on, largely based on caseload statistics. At this point, we are doing it anticipated caseload statistics. So, for example, the eligibility component of the system is a big part that benefits the Medicaid population, and we anticipated that most of the people coming through the system were going to be Medicaid, and therefore that was about a 67% of those costs were allocated to Medicaid and thus to DHS. An area like SHOP, where DHS has nothing to do with, there was nothing allocated to Medicaid. So that's kind of the first step in it. The second step is then with the dollars that are allocated to Medicaid, then we apportion those dollars between the state and the federal government. As Commissioner Jessen said, we've got the 90% reimbursement for most of those expenditures as part of an enhancement the federal government put in place. There are some pieces of expenditure that we only get 75% on, so it's worked out to be roughly about 85% across the board on the Medicaid side of the expenditures for the exchange IT infrastructure.
Okay, so, and so
Representative
just...
Representative Mack.
Yeah, appreciate that, Mr. Chair. So just to... If I the detail is helpful to understand how it all kind of is broken up, but kind of in a nutshell, am I hearing correctly that there has been no additional DHS funds outside of what was budgeted for up until this point, that it's all been borne by what was expected in the federal dollars and MnSure share, but it's all essentially fallen within the projected budget that DHS had delineated for this area of its infrastructure?
Deputy Johnson?
Mr. Chair and Representative Mack, that's correct. As Commissioner Jessen said, we have been managing within our budget for a number of the costs related to the cleanup of cases, working through problems, managing the paper applications, and so forth. I would say that if there are additional IT expenditures in the project going forward, those would be cost allocated to DHS on whatever the appropriate portion would be, and so those might be additional costs beyond what was anticipated, although we were appropriated a chunk of dollars to represent our share of the MnSure budget going forward, so that it would be relative to how those new costs relate to that budget that we were already appropriated.
Okay. And then just one final question.
Okay. And then Representative Huntley.
Okay.
Representative Mack?
My one question, I don't know if this is better for a commissioner or
But my question, you know, and being in touch with the counties and some of the unexpected issues in terms of paper applications, it's been a bit more manpower, less that's been able to be fulfilled by the IT infrastructure at this point. I would imagine that, and I know, you know, hearing from the county, some of the additional costs and stress that that's brought on, is that also accounted for within this, or is DHS reimbursing counties for those additional costs, or counties having to kind of bear any costs that they're dealing with as a result of MNsure and the you know, lack of functionality in the IT infrastructure right now? Are counties just having to take on that, those overrun costs of manpower and the you know, paper applications and things like that, or how is that flowing between DHS and the counties?
Mr. Chair and Representative Mack, to a large extent, the counties are continuing to they operate within their own budget, so we're not giving them additional money in direct answer to your question. However, as part of the federal government's rollout, they're allowing a 75% match on administrative expenditures related to eligibility, which we did put through a request for and it got approved from the federal government. And so that is benefiting the counties in the sense that they are now retaining additional federal reimbursement for their expenditures that didn't exist prior to the implementation of MNsure. Mr. Chair,
Mr. Johnson,
Representative Mack, Commissioner also reminded me we're actually at the Department of Human Services managing the paper applications, not the counties. The counties right now are not managing paper applications. They're all being handled within the department.
Representative Huntley?
Just a question, or not a question, but a comment for the next time. I'm looking at this expense sheet. If you could break down in the future how much of the Medicaid amount is state money and how much is federal money, and the same for the Minnesota Care, that would make it a little bit clearer for me anyway.
Mr. Leitz, is that something you can accomplish?
Mr. Chair, Representative Huntley, yes.
Excellent. Any further questions of members? I'm seeing none. I think we'll move to the public testimony. We kind of transitioned into the figures around enrollment data and budget update and covered that rather thoroughly. So we'll move to the public testimony. I don't have a list of testifiers, but if there's anyone from the public who wishes to come up and offer their thoughts, now would be the time. You're welcome. Seeing no one from the public wishing to step forward and offer thoughts, the last item on the agenda is to discuss future meeting dates. Representative Atkins, you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In consulting with Mr. Kwapik and you and Stace, and we've got the challenge that we're going to have is with committee deadlines and all of that. What we were thinking about, the other thing is we want to keep in mind that the enrollment deadline of the end of March the end of March. So what we talked about was April 4th, Friday, April 4th, 1 o'clock for the next meeting. I know that that's their deadline for budget folks, but it's just what we're kind of, so we'll all be around kind of one way or another, and we'll, so mark your calendars for April 4th, 1 o'clock, and hopefully in a cooler room.
And we will still have the March 15th budget report, and we will distribute that via email to members that will, well, I mean, we won't have to. MNsure is required to send it to us. Any comments on that proposal? Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And we'll juggle multiple meetings if we need to, but I also want to make sure that we're also thinking about the MNsure board, because obviously today we were on the same day with them, and that made some awkwardness and squeezed their time. And I don't know if you've looked at their schedule as well, but if
their board's meetings are on Wednesday,
okay,
which is
we'll
one of the reasons we chose a Friday.
Meeting.
We apologies for winding on this day with the. The board
Thank
meeting
you. I
it
just
didn't
wanted
occur,
to be
but maybe we
to
should ask. We didn't, you know, like Representative Atkins mentioned, we consulted with Mr. Kwapik and Ms. Weeks and the two of us. MNsure, does that the 4th, April 4th, work for you guys? We should.
I did send him a text about 30 seconds
ago.
Oh,
you did?
So
okay.
I'm not sure I sent it to the right people. Might have gotten to my own son. I don't know.
So, Mr. Chair, we're sort of ad-hocking this as we go, so bear with us a little bit. I know that Chair Buettner is not available that day. I believe that – I know that one of the things I think this committee will be interested in that point will be where we landed on the enrollment piece. I'm checking with staff to see – make sure we have coverage of that information for that meeting. I think it's a – if I was to put it, I would say it's a less than ideal date right now. If there's one that we could possibly find that would be different, I just know that the chair won't be here for that particular date, but I don't want to cause you problems either. So,
Mr. Chairman, to that point,
Representative Atkins.
We're trying to figure that out. The challenge with the following week then, though, is I think we're prohibited from having meetings on the 11th. Is that right? Did I get that?
I think so.
So we're – and you guys are – board meeting-wise are on – is that – would be on Wednesday the
– the 16th is the next board meeting, Mr. Chair.
The 16th?
The 16th would be
not the
next.
Not the 9th?
No, the 9th would be – we don't have a board meeting on the 9th, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Let me –
I mean, I'm going to be here, so.
So if we look at, unless there's objection, then if we look at Wednesday morning, the 9th, does that work for folks?
We're past budget deadlines
well,
at that point, correct?
Well, third deadline for budget bills is the 4th. Yeah. So that actually, maybe the following Wednesday is almost a better day then. We'll determine time. So what I'd like to do is look at committee meeting schedules. It'll be either the morning or the afternoon of that Wednesday, the 9th. Okay, and we'll try to get something out literally today or in the next day or two. Sound good?
Sounds good. Any further comments? Seeing none, we stand adjourned. Thank you, members.